Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Yeah, I think Keon has been focused, dialed in. His agent and I have developed a good relationship. You know, he's actually kin to Keon. And so I think he was very blunt with him as well, just off of some of our conversations. And Keon can take it. Like, for a young man, I give him a lot of credit. Of course, anybody can take praise. It's not easy to take criticism. And he took it unbelievable. And that's the thing I tried to stress to him when he got back is you did a lot of positive things. Don't focus on just the things that we want to see improve. And he's worked hard. He's been here the whole time. You know, you can see when him and Josh were here, they're forming that rapport and kind of picking up where they were pre-injury last year. So I'm excited where he's at.
Bill Shim, Brandon Bean from minicamp wrapping up at the end of last week. Good morning, Jeremy and Joe. Keon Coleman took that criticism to the basketball court and dropped 60 in a charity game, dunked on everyone, rained threes. It was impressive.
See, the threes are like...
Step back.
Watching him play football, him dunking isn't like the craziest thing to me.
It was still impressive.
Him hitting a step back three and it just looking as clean as it does is the thing that's crazy to me.
60 points in a charity game.
He hit 40 at the half. I bet he probably
he dialed it down.
Didn't he probably leave some for the others in the second half?
He might have. Joining us on the Western Hotline, we've got a lot to get to with Matt Bove, friend of the show. You know Matt Bove from It's Always Game Day in Buffalo with Sal Capaccio and, of course, sports director WKBW. He joins us on the Western Hotline. Little U.S. Open and also something, an exciting thing that Matt's got coming up on KBW as the weeks go on from here. Matt, good morning.
Morning, gentlemen. Thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate it.
Did you see the Keon highlights of him going ham on everybody on the court?
I always just get a little frustrated that there are people on this planet who are that good at multiple sports. I feel like if you're going to be really good at something, just let everybody be really good at one thing. To have people who are that good at multiple sports just seems even more unfair than it already is.
I mean, don't you think there's a good chance he's the best basketball player in the NFL?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, the fact that he played college basketball has him
right in
pretty elite company with the league. He's definitely up there. He's definitely in the top five. But there's probably some guys who are in the NFL who are so good at football that they never even considered playing basketball, mm-hmm. who are probably just also absolute freaks as well. So, yeah, he's definitely one of them. Like, it's just, I did see the highlights, and it's just like, this is absurd, like, that this guy can do this stuff.
One of the things, like, a quick search of athletes, NFL players that played college basketball, it gets to mostly guys that were just kind of, I don't know, they were in college. Like Donovan McNabb was not quite a walk-on, but he played at Syracuse on that team. He's with that team a little bit. Or, I mean, Antoine Randall-El.
I think of the tight ends over time, right?
Sure,
like Antonio Gates. Jimmy Graham. Like, every year, I feel like there's a new tight end in the NFL where, like, oh, this guy played basketball at, you know, wherever.
Yeah, Julius Peppers played in North Carolina, averaged 7 points per game.
Mm-hmm.
So you get some. With Keon, it's funny, Joe was saying, like, step-back threes versus the dunks. The dunks show you that above-the-rim kind of skill set that he has, and they use that a little bit, man. I wonder if you feel like there's more there, more above the rim stuff from Keon, because I tend to think that they could do that a little bit more if they want to.
I think the game that we should look back on, and it's tough because it's easy, it's a layup, no pun intended here, but the Seahawks game last year was his most impressive game because we saw a little bit of everything. But yeah, that going up and getting it above the rim, I think about the play that they had. He had a touchdown in the corner of the end zone. On the play before, they tried it, incomplete pass. They went back to it again, and then after he made the catch, he slapped Woolen on the head, like, good try. I'll get you again later in the game or something. Just kind of like almost embarrassing him. It was a really impressive play, and I think that that's what they've always wanted to see out of him, and they just didn't have that when he came back. I think that's the plan. I think for him, it's like go be the guy who can make contested catches, who he can throw it up. There was another great example later in the year against the Jets where Josh just bought time, rolled out to the side, and just threw it straight up in the air, basically. And it was either going to be an interception or he was going to trust his guy to get it, and Keon Coleman came down with it. So they need to see strides from him in year two. He's definitely a player who is important. I think there's other players who are more important, but a big step from him would go a long way.
Matt Bove joining us on the Wester Hotline. Before we get to some other things, one of the reasons you're joining us today is because you are starting a new retrospective series that begins tonight. So tell us what's going on WKBW.
Yeah, so tonight we are starting a 7-part series. It's going to start at 7:30. It's called Leading the Charge, 52 Years of Fandemonium. This has been something we have been working on for months. And listen, we're going into the final season in the stadium. This is going to bring out a ton of emotions for a lot of people. As we were starting to think about our plans for how could we say goodbye to this building, we were looking at the schedule, and I'm like, you know what? When we get to the fall, we're going to be spending most of our time talking about football. It feels like we really need to carve out some time to say goodbye to this place and share some stories. And we're right in that window now where up until training camp, there's not a whole heck of a lot going on from at least a Bill standpoint. So we have been interviewing former players, current players, staff members, fans, just anybody who has a story with that stadium to try and have them kind of take us down a walk down memory lane. So the stories have been incredible. We are super excited to put together. We kind of have 7 episodes, and each one of them focuses on something a little bit different. Like tonight's episode, the first episode, is much more about the early years at the stadium, and you'll hear from people like Joe Ferguson and Joe DeLaMalier, and there'll be some Marv Levy and Jim Kelly mixed in as well with some fans and all that kind of stuff. And then as we get further into the series, we'll kind of get back to where we are now and hear from some of the current players about their most iconic moments. But the thing that has been so impressive to me is that everybody I've talked to, I've tried to ask a couple questions that overlap. And one of them is just, what is your favorite memory or your favorite game inside that stadium? And it has been very surprising to hear how different some of the answers are. I thought going into it, it was going to be a lot of the comeback game and a lot of 51-3. And there was a ton of that. But it's really cool to hear people or watch them kind of process it in their head and go back and be like, this is my favorite game. Yeah. Or they share a story about why it's their favorite game. And then you get to the point where people have just broken down in tears because they're thinking about who they were at that game with, if that person's not there anymore, why they care about the Bills so much. So it has been a very emotional experience. So I'm really excited to see it all kind of come together.
If going all the way back to the opening of the stadium, was there any sort of conversation you had about how it was at the time, whether state of the art or how big it was? Because, you know, now building stadiums is norm. It's very normal, and they build these great palaces. But I wonder what it was like the day it opened and how awe-inspiring it would have been in that time.
Oh, I've got so many stories about that. And that's why it was perfect to talk to Joe DeLaMalier and Joe Ferguson. So they carpooled to the game together. Their first preseason game, that's when the Bills still had training camp at Niagara University. It was a night game, and they left at noon because they were like, listen, we want to go and be there as early as humanly possible. But then when they got down to Orchard Park, they got stuck in traffic for like an hour because it was also the Erie County Fair. And they were like, who plans the start of the Erie County Fair on the same day that we were opening a new stadium? This seems a little bit bush league. But they talked about walking into the building and it just being this palace. And then Sal Majorana from the Democrat and Chronicle, he's somebody who will be on the episode tonight too. He was also at that first game. The perspective he shared, the scoreboard at the time was $1 million. And then $1 million was unheard of for something like a scoreboard, considering the Rock Pile didn't even have replays. So for the small little grainy replays to be there at the stadium, and it's funny because you go through, we've been going through all the WKBW archive video of some of these games, and you're seeing all the stories about what it's going to look like in the locker room and what it's going to look like in the stands. I mean, compared to the Rock Pile, it was a palace. And these players realized that, and they say for a good 10 or 15 years, they felt like they had the best stadium in the NFL. Now, you know, it's a stadium that's got a lot of character. I don't think anybody would call it the best stadium in the NFL, but it's funny because 50 years ago, it probably was one of the nicest stadiums in the league.
Yeah. I think I learned about how they used to do replays recently on the scoreboard and, like, blew my mind. Like, it doesn't even look like video, like how they would do it. Like, up until maybe even the mid-90s. On scoreboards,
really?
Like, I don't know. I forget how it was described to me. The other thing I'm realizing Matt, because I'm hearing you talk about tonight, this episode, and I'm excited because I like hearing about those pre-90s teams because we hear so many stories about the 90s. And you'll have, like, I know, like the goalposts came down and there'll be a million good memories. I guess I'm just realizing that there wasn't a playoff game played in that stadium for the first, like, 16, 17 years of its history. Like, 89 is the first time you have to go to get a playoff game at that stadium, which is pretty wild.
Well, so, and to your point, I'm 32. I'm from Western New York. I've been here my entire life. When I started the idea for the series, I literally just took out a pen and paper and started writing down names of people who I wanted to talk to. But it's incredible, almost the disconnect from somebody who's even in my job and who is from here about the years before the Super Bowl era. Maybe those are just so big that that's what we immediately go to. But I'm looking at the page and I'm like, I feel like I'm missing like almost 15 years of Bills football inside that stadium that I need to make sure that I address. And then you start to think about, like, the name that came to mind was Jack Kemp. And I'm like, oh, wait, Jack Kemp never played in the stadium. Like, he only played in the Rock Pile. So who are the guys who opened the stadium? And honestly, a lot of it is the OJ era. The 70s are pretty much all the OJ era. So that was kind of what the big story inside that building was for all of those years. And then there were a couple guys who surprised me at how long they had been here. Like, one of the people we'll talk to during the series is Daryl Talley. Like, he started playing for the Bills in 1983. I didn't know that. I thought that he was kind of a later 80s guy into the Super Bowl year. No, he was there for a couple years where they weren't very good. And then, obviously, once you get to 85, they've got that great draft class, and then they continue to kind of build off of that. So this will be – tonight's episode especially will be much more about kind of like the early years. And I think that for me, it was very informative just because there was a lot of stuff I didn't know. Like, did you guys know – do you know the first play inside that stadium for a preseason game? Do you know about this?
I do, but I only know it because I would have looked it up like somewhere in the last like month or two. But go ahead.
Jeremy, do you know?
I don't.
The first ever play inside the stadium was a kick return touchdown against the Bills. Like, doesn't it feel like that really set the tone for the last 52 years of Bills football?
Yeah. Yep.
So, Matt, when you're talking to whether it's old timers or current players, you know, there's the nostalgia of saying goodbye to the stadium. Is there a feeling of excitement even among all of them about the new stadium?
Yes. For sure, definitely. It's mixed, though. Like, I say yes, for sure, definitely, because that is kind of the thing that almost everybody ends with, of how excited they are for the new stadium. But there's also a little caveat that they all put in there of, we're very excited for the new stadium, but we really want to make sure that it still has the energy and the atmosphere that we have at the current building, just because, you guys know, you've been around to a lot of different stadiums. It's not easy to replicate that. I know the fans are going to be a lot of the same people, right? A lot of the fans who are going to be there for the last year this year will also be in the stands for the first year next year. But it's just making sure that you can get that energy and that home field advantage. Now, from like an actual technical standpoint, the sound is going to be incredible in the new stadium, and the way that that place is going to trap the sound under that canopy, I think is going to have this place be really loud, and everybody's kind of right on top of the field. So I think that will help. But like, the atmosphere at a Bills game now is so unmatched. There are a couple stadiums in the league that are anything like it. Arrowhead is like it. Pittsburgh is a little bit like it. Lambeau's like it. So for what we have now, it's so unique. So, yes, I think there is just a – we're really excited to see this new building because the fans deserve it. This is going to be so incredible for the fans, but we need to make sure that Buffalo continues to have the home field atmosphere and advantage that they currently do. So that's kind of the typical way people have explained it to me.
Which is a big part of the story and, you know, kind of plays into the history of the stadium. Matt Bove joining us, sports director at WKBW, also does the Always Game Day in Buffalo podcast with Sal. Seven-part series for about the final year at Highmark, the history of Highmark Stadium as well, that starts on Channel 7 tonight. So, all right, the next part of what I want to get to, Matt, is how about the drought years? Because, you know, those are not exactly glory years. However, I feel like there's a strong case to be made that those are the years that the mafia really forged itself to be what it is. And that's why when this version of the Bills that plays in the stadium comes to be, they got a full army behind them pretty much from day one.
Oh, for sure. That, to me, is the years that I immediately think of. As somebody who's my age, I remember going to games during the drought, whether I was in high school with my dad or whether I was in college with all my buddies. We even had season tickets for a couple of years. And it's funny, because for as terrible as the drought was, there are some incredible games for good and bad reasons, just kind of mixed into the drought. And that's a lot of what this series is going to highlight, is those moments that you were like, wow, I can't believe that happened. And a couple of the players who you're like, wow, like I can go back. We didn't talk to him, but when I think about the drought, like a random name that comes to mind is Roscoe Parrish, right? And you're like, okay, I could think back to the Roscoe Parrish punt returns during the drought and watch those on YouTube and just start my morning that way. But it is funny because that is the start of Bills Mafia. And this fan base has always been very passionate, but it really elevated to its credit during those years and then was ready to kind of take on the spotlight that comes with having a great team. So yeah, the drought is definitely going to, there is an entire episode about the drought that's coming in a couple weeks because it's a big part of Bills history. And it's crazy that after they played their last playoff game in the 90s, there wasn't something again up until the 2020 season in Orchard Park. And then that year was COVID. So there was only like 7,000 people there.
Yeah.
And that also leads us to why, now once again, this is a little bit of a tangent, why some of those playoff games in the years after the COVID year were so spectacular. Like a very common answer that I got was the Patriots playoff game in the wild card round.
That's one of the best,
that's Josh Allen's answer. That is his best moment in that stadium. If you ask him, what's your favorite game you've ever played in the stadium? That is the one that goes to him. And there's a lot of people who would feel the exact same way. Because even though it's not the same, the magnitude isn't the same, it's kind of our generation's 51-3. Like, there was really never a doubt in that game. That was a celebration by the second quarter, where the 51-3 game was a celebration to go to the Super Bowl, which is also just crazy to think about, that they won an AFC championship 51-3. It's just bananas. But yeah, the Patriots game is a very common answer for people.
I would imagine the three answers, are there any others you got other than the Patriots playoff game, the 51-3 game, and probably the comeback game? Like, that probably would be almost everybody's answer, I would think.
31-0 over New England on opening day was a great one. Like, for me, that's
31-0 was an answer that got brought up a couple times by people because it felt like a lot of people thought that was back. A common answer is specifically with like their favorite play. It was not a full house by any stretch, but a lot of people brought up the Taron Johnson pick six against the Ravens as their favorite memory inside the stadium, and a couple players felt that. A couple people, I think this is a hint of recency bias, a couple people brought up the Patriots game after the DeMar Hamlin situation, and I think because of the start of that game, like how magical that first play was, so that was a game that had gotten brought up a lot. A couple people brought up some games from back in the day, like early Monday Night Football against the Raiders in the mid-70s and how good the Bills were then. There's a lot of games that have gotten brought up. Oh, and then even a couple people brought up the Patriots game during the drought that they beat in week three.
Yeah.
Like that's another, and then the week before that was the Raiders game where they also erased a huge deficit. So like there are some, I would say, answers that a lot of people had, but then there's like five or six games that we didn't even talk about that people gave answers to, and then they gave reasons why.
Did the 6-3 Browns game come up?
You know what? I remember where I was for the 6-3 Browns game. I wasn't at the stadium. And I just remember thinking to myself, like, why are we doing this to ourselves?
Yeah.
What are we doing? Like, why am I watching this football game?
Oh, I'm sure you got to it at some point, but or that maybe somebody mentioned it, but just because of the sheer weather, I mean, the snow game against the Colts in 2017 is an all-time day at that stadium.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, absolutely. We have had a ton of people who have referenced being at the stadium that day and watching the progress from what was supposed to happen pregame to all of a sudden before kickoff, them not being able to see a thing. That's been cool, too, because I've had a chance to talk to a lot of the players who have like been on the team for this era and them going back to days like that, like McDermott talking about that. Sean, I talked to Sean for a while about this, and he actually shared some incredible stories about the stadium, too. So there's a lot of cool perspectives. But the snow game, then you start to think of the names in that game. Joe Webb, Deontay Thompson, Nathan Peterman starts the game. Calvin Benjamin has a touchdown in that game. Like, there are some very fun names to look back on from that day.
Matt Bove on the Western Hotline. The series starts tonight on Channel 7, a retrospective seven-part series looking back at Highmark Stadium. Matt, before we let you go, a thought on J.J. Spaun in the U.S. Open?
How cool was that? What an ending. Mm. That was so awesome. Like, listen, I love golf, but I also love watching elite players win. Good for J.J. Spaun. Yeah. I like to see the underdog story. And also the way the leaderboard played out, I'm happy that he was the guy to get the win of the other names on the leaderboard. I was kind of pulling for a Scotty comeback over the course of the day, even though it became pretty apparent early on that that was not going to happen. I just admittedly like when an American wins the U.S. Open. I always think that's cool. But the way he did it was really, really awesome. Yeah. And guys, first major with a lab putter.
That's right.
Like we're on the verge of something here.
Yep, that's right. Can I tell you the thought I had when he made that putt? Like after watching 10 replays, this is going to be a random thought, and I don't know if anybody else thinks things like this, but I think you'll easily identify with this. That putt from 64 feet and making it like that, and the reaction from the crowd. The thought I had was, if you did that in front of a wedding party on a random Tuesday, it would have the same reaction. Like, that's what golf does, is like, hold on, let's see this. Oh, we made it! And the place would go nuts, and it wouldn't have to be the U.S. Open, because it was just, so much of that reaction, I think, is, sure, he won the Open, but the actual shot itself is just like a very organic, kind of like, whoa, the guy hit the ball from really far in the hole, and that was pretty cool.
We did my stag party before I got married like 5 or 6 years ago at a golf course, and there was a putting green in the front. And one of the things we did was we charged $5 for 3 putts, and it was like a 75-foot putt. And whoever made the putt first got whatever the prize was. I think it was like a pair of AirPods. And you had just like 75 people standing around the green watching everybody do their attempts at this. And I was, believe it or not, I was the first person to make the putt. And you could have made you could have thought that I just want to make
right.
reaction of just the celebration of, oh my God. And I did give the AirPods back, by the way. My thought watching the putt last night, because you've seen all the different angles this morning, was if it doesn't go in, I feel like it's a slippery distance and it's not a gimme.
Yeah.
Like it's
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9 to 5 for a 5 to 9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Coming in with a little bit of pace, that's my mind of like, oh gosh, like that would have been a terrifying putt to try and win the U.S. Open. So for him to do it the way he did, I think everybody's probably happy about that.
Yep, very much so. Matt, thanks for the time, and looking forward to seeing the series.
Thanks, gentlemen. Appreciate you having me on.
Matt Bove, sports director at WKBW. It starts tonight, 7:30, Channel 7's series, looking back at Highmark Stadium, a seven-part series, so check that out. Paul Hamilton, when we return, we'll get his thoughts on the latest reporting on J.J. Paterka, whether or not the Sabres can be pushed to do this and trade him, if that's what's going to happen, if an offer sheet could happen. We'll get to Paul's thoughts on that as we approach the start of the NHL offseason. The draft is just 11 days away. Jeremy and Joe on WGR.
It's Paul Hamilton.
That's what they called me in college, Mr. Bone.
He has the facts to back up his opinions.
People ask me, well, how are the Sabres going to win tonight? I don't have a clue.
On WGR, Sports Radio 550.
Mr. Paul Hamilton, we'll check in with him. Getting closer to the draft, the combine's in the books, the NHL Stanley Cup Final rolls tomorrow. Game 6 could be the last game of the season, on to the next season. The schedule comes out soon. I want to say like soon after. Doesn't the schedule come out like between the Cup Final and the draft?
I think so. You startled me with the draft. Paul, I can't believe the draft's in 11 days.
Yeah, that's crazy. But we don't have to travel this year. We'll be down at the stadium.
Right, because of what's the term they're using? Decentralized?
Yes.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty much just like the NFL. The players will be in Los Angeles. Be introduced there just like the NFL players are, but all the teams will be back in their facilities or in the Sabres case, in the Bills facilities.
What this means, Paul, is the time-honored tradition of, ooh, this GM just walked over to this GM's table and they appear to be talking. We won't get that anymore.
Oh, those are the best.
Hey, guys, I was listening. I got two things for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're talking about basketball. Keon hitting those, what, 60 points, you said?
60 points in a charity game, yeah.
Did you see Caitlin Clark, who had missed five games, came back against the defending champions of the WNBA, who were undefeated, and hit 25 in the first half?
Yep.
Uh-huh. She did three threes in 38 seconds.
Yep. It was, Paul, all right, let's get to Caitlin Clark quickly. Yeah, so we had, our nanny was going to Indiana to see Caitlin Clark. She bought tickets to see the Fever months and months and months ago. And before she left, I asked, like, is Caitlin going to play? We weren't really sure about the timeline. And not only did she play, but, yeah, she rained fire on the Liberty, giving them their first loss of the season. And talk about, like, all-time athletes where you go just to see one player and then they deliver. I mean, when I saw Twitter start pointing out that she was starting, like, hot. Like, I got to the screen, kids to the screen, like, let's see her do her thing. And it was super impressive. When she's playing like that, it's tough to top.
I had never seen a WNBA game, and I watch every game that's on TV that she's in. I just love watching her play. It's so much fun watching her play. The other thing I wanted to tell you guys, it's kind of flown under the radar, but he was one of the better players in the NFL. Former Buffalo Bill Stu Barber passed away.
Yep,
and he was like a five-time all AFL player, and he was voted, when the AFL went out, he was voted the second-best left tackle in AFL history. He was on the second team. And if I recall correctly, too, he was also the GM of the Bills at some time, too. So I did want to mention that Stu Barber did pass away.
Yeah, we mentioned, Paul, he was also a linebacker. He started as a linebacker and then made the move to tackle, Stu Barber.
When I was looking up his stuff, I noticed his first year he did have an interception for a touchdown.
Yeah. How many tackles in NFL history have a pick?
Have a
pick six?
That might be more impressive than Jason Peters catching a touchdown.
What about Jason Peters blocking a punt and recovering it for a touchdown?
That's pretty good. That was pretty good. Yeah.
All right, Paul. So
in the NFL also, but chose the Bills instead.
Yeah.
So oh, nice.
Paul, the latest on JJ Paterka. It's been like a slow drip, whether you're talking deadline or, you know, along the way, and now Elliot Friedman going so far as to say that he wants to go somewhere else. So there are a lot of different layers to this, whether it's the offer sheet or a straight trade, or if the Sabres want to try and just say, like, forget it, we have your rights for a couple of years. What do you think Kevin Adams, and for that matter Jarmo Kekäläinen, as a team that they are, what do you think they should do with Paterka here?
Well, they've had a couple of months to try to convince him that this is the right place and their plan is going to work. And it seemed like, just listening to Adams talk, that it was something that he was going to have to do. I'm wondering if he has to convince Tuck also. I mean, Tuck didn't sound real excited about, re-signing with the Sabres. You know, he basically said, well, I haven't talked to my wife about it and we'll see. And, you know, Kevin Adams said it was a priority. It can start on July 1st. Negotiating with him. And, you know, my thought is this. I mean, I think Byram is a different case. He wants to have the roles that Rasmus Dahlin and Owen Power already have, and that's just not something he's going to get in Buffalo. So I think he's a little bit different, maybe. But my question is it starting again? I mean, it seems like every 3 to 5 years, you know, the Sabres get players, and then they develop them, and some of them become very good players. And then all of a sudden, because of the losing and whatever's going on, they want to go. Is that happening again?
Yeah.
I mean, what happens if, indeed, Tuck doesn't want to be here anymore, and Paterka doesn't want to be here anymore, and Byram, Paterka, and Tuck get traded? Well, what are Dahlin and Thompson saying then? Mm-hmm. You know, do they now get in line? You know, do they – and what is the reason? Do they not believe in Ruff? Do they not believe in Adams?
Let me jump in.
The losing?
Yeah, let me ask you about the Adams point because, you know, Paul, the Sabres are obviously in a unique spot, the longest drought in the sport, but this is probably one of those examples where in a timeline of a team failing, there would be a change. And it would be a new voice coming in to tell Paterka and Tuck, here's what I'm going to do. Here's what we're going to do. And I just wonder, like, as you kind of lay that out, as Kevin Adams returns for a sixth season, that it's kind of tough for him to try and make that case to any player because he's probably made that case to that player before.
Yeah, might Alex Tuck say something like, you know what, I have a year left in my contract. Let me play it out. Let's see where we're at the end of the year. Let's see what happens. You're telling me that this is a positive for this team and we're going to move forward. Let's find out. I mean, that could happen. Who knows? You know, he might just say, all right, I have a contract. There's 1 year left. Let's see what happens type of scenario. But J.J. Paterka hasn't been around here that long. Right. You know, and as far as an offer sheet goes, I kind of got away from that. Yes, there's 55 goals in the last 2 years, but his numbers are not real good. And his analytic numbers. So my thought is, would he get an offer sheet? Offer sheets, as you know, aren't that common. Now, the Blues signed two players to offer sheets last year, but they don't happen all that often. I wish they did. I know you do also.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that I think is a tool that NHL GM should be using.
It also feels like in this exact spot, it's one begging for one because the player is motivated to sign one. And players, for a long time, Paul, it was kind of said that players might not want to upset the apple cart, and they might not want to do that.
The Sabres have so much cap space, they can match almost anything. So, I mean, anything a team would offer Paterka, if they want to match it, they can. So that sometimes makes teams shy away also. St. Louis put Edmonton in a bad spot last year. And, you know, and they wound up getting both players. And both players played pretty well for the Blues this year until one got hurt. But they put the Oilers in a pretty bad spot. An offer sheet to Paterka, I don't think puts the Sabres in a bad spot. So sometimes teams figure, well, why waste our time doing that? The Sabres have enough space, they can just match it.
The only question is, would they want to match it with a long-term contract? If they already have a problem, wouldn't they feel like if we sign him, we're signing for a problem?
I'd match it. I'd still want to make a trade if I could, and that doesn't include a bunch of draft picks. You know, they would get, depending on the how much the contract is worth, they would just get draft picks in return. Adam said it last year. He said it again. He's not interested in prospects and draft picks. It's not what he's looking for in the trade market. So, but I'd really be interested because, as I said, it hasn't like J.J. Paterka has been in the middle of losing a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, his years in Rochester, they did very well in the playoffs. I mean, and he did very well. And that's not that far back. So that makes me also wonder, is it the losing? Is it the players got really, really upset, whether it was warranted or not. I'm not saying one way or the other. But as you know, they got really, really upset that every time they came into their building, they got booed off the ice. And, you know, they, as I heard you say once, Jeremy, they kind of declared war on their fans.
Yeah.
And I don't know if some of the players got over that. And we can all say, well, just get over it. But I don't know if that plays into any of this, or if it's Ruff, or if it's Adams. Is it ownership? Do they look at it that this just keeps going round and round and round, and it, no matter, you know, there's been a lot of different players that have come through. They've redone the team more than once. They've redone the coaches more than once. They've redone the GMs more than once, and nothing seems to work. Players might look at that and say, why should this work now?
Paul Hamilton on the Western Hotline. Paul, last thing on this, like, all right, if we're zooming out, you know, you said, is it happening again? Last time the Sabres did this, it's Reinhardt, it's Eichel, it's everybody that's ever, like, everything you can get something for, Ristolainen. Do you think that maybe in this case, if Adams was to move Byram and Paterka and maybe one other asset or the ninth pick, that they could use this as an opportunity, and this might be a little bit of an optimistic take on this, which, of course, like, good things can happen. Could they use this as, all right, this is our window, we've got pieces to move that have value, and we're not necessarily up against it. It's not Reinhardt with a contract. It's not Eichel with a surgery. It's there would be more options, more teams they could work with in this kind of, not tear down, but if they wanted to flip it and make the best they could, maybe they would have the opportunity to do that this time in a way that they didn't last time.
True. and you mentioned Kekalainen's name. And on the other side of this coin, could Alex Tuch say to himself, I like that. I like that he's here. You know, I think he could add something to the front office. So could that, if he's leaning one way, could that help him lead to the other way? Where, you know, at least get some thinking a little bit that I like this move. You know, I don't know if he does or doesn't. I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet, but it's something that at least the Sabres have added a guy who has been a general manager for over 10 years in this league, who's been bold in what he does. Players might like that. They might like what they see. Because this is my opinion. I have not heard this from any player, anybody else. I just have this feeling, if this happens again, one more year, I think they're all gone. I think Darlene will want to go. I don't think Darlene can take one more year of this. It just seemed like he was at his fill last year, but he has told us that he wants to fix this with the Sabres. He wants to stay. I believe him. But if this happens another year, I just think that's it. I think, you know, they'll be lining up to get out of here.
Paul Hamilton.
That's my opinion.
Yeah, Paul Hamilton. Everyone's got a breaking point, you would think. Thanks, Paul.
Take care, guys.
Paul's appearance brought to you by Relax Honda. Relax, we got this NHL draft in 11 days. Free agency once we get to July. So the offseason approaches, and, you know, you want to say, like, it's a big one, of course.
I mean, the way Paul just set it up, it is, like, the biggest one.
Yeah, it's a big one. 803.
Spectrum Business keeps real businesses, like Rise Bakery, connected.
As a business owner, my Spectrum services help simplify my day. Everything we do is easier knowing that we've got a reliable connection. And it helps our business just run really smoothly. Even though our techniques are very ancient, we rely just as heavily on technology. Spectrum allows my business to go from surviving to thriving.
Keep your business running smoothly with Spectrum Internet, starting at $40 a month. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
550, that's our phone number. You can give us a ring if you hear anything from Paul you want to chime in on, you can. Jeremy and Joe, happy Monday. Back to it. Mid-June. NBA Finals, back to it tonight.
Yes.
The Thunder.
Push off Shea and the Thunder against the Pacers. Let's go.
Push off.
Sick of that guy.
Yeah?
Pushes off on every shot. He modeled his whole game on one Michael Jordan shot. Something I saw or had experienced at a wedding. I'm going to bring back a little wedding idea of the day for second from this weekend.
I'm excited for that. The return of the wedding idea of the day. Next. Return to the wedding idea of the day.
All right, so I went to a wedding on Saturday. Beautiful wedding. Friend Joe, who I grew up with, and his wife Lindsay, they had late night bites.
Love it.
Like, we had that, right? We
yep,
did pizza.
It's important
and
to get food out there, yeah.
Has every wedding you've ever done that with done pizza? Probably?
Yeah, we did pizza. We had pizzas delivered.
Okay.
I went to one in Rochester that had garbage plates.
Bingo. This wedding was in Rochester. They had a make-your-own garbage plate station.
It's pretty good.
At 11 o'clock.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
After hours of dancing. It kind of intimidated me at first, though. Like, is a garbage plate really what I want to eat right now? How am I going to feel tomorrow? And then eventually was, you know what? That's why it's here. You don't care about how you're going to feel tomorrow. Give me the garbage plate.
Yeah.
And it was great.
And how did you feel the next day?
Terrible.
Okay.
Terrible.
Hmm.
There were consequences.
Yeah, I guess so.
But mix it up. You don't have to do just pizza. I think they had pizza too, but garbage plate.
Are you in your go-to wedding years?
Yes. I feel like every year for the last 3 years,
it's been like six weddings a year.
Once the summer starts, it's like I had one Saturday, and then this coming weekend I don't have one, but then the next weekend after that I have one.
Yeah.
It's like every other weekend for eventually that runs out. I think.
There's probably some analytics you could run about weddings per expected weddings per 60.
Yes.
How old are you? Oh, I'm 32. Oh, your expected weddings got to be pretty high.
Your expected weddings is 3.5 for the summer.
Yeah. For me, though, at 45, like expected weddings, we're down to like, it's 0.5.
0.5.
0.8 expected weddings per summer.
Right.
They're not that many.
Every other year is a good result for you at this point.
Pretty much
until people's kids start getting married, because you're about to be 50.
Yeah, is there going
to
be like a double bell curve where you're like
no,
double bell.
It ends up looking like the JJ Spawn's win probability yesterday.
There you go. Right.
It's like a roller coaster.
Expected weddings. Yeah, I don't think we have we're down to one or two a year. There'd have been there are years when you're in your late 20s or early 30s or whatever, mid 20s, where people out there listen for like, oh, I had 11 in one year.
You know, 11.
Yeah, you might have big numbers.
I think we had 4, but 11 is maybe 5 even. But 11, that is
your whole summer.
They couldn't all be in the summer, right? It'd be every weekend of the summer.
Right.
Right? It'd be May through August basically.
The coordination that would take.
Right.
Maybe 2 per weekend.
Maybe you have to pick one over the other. Yeah. Well, at 45, I don't have as many. This is what I'm going to say. Oh, no weddings this summer. My wife's going to text me. We have 3. Like, oh, all right. I trust she's right about that.
Yeah.
All right. 803-0550. When we return, something Sam Monson said over the weekend, Bills fans, you're going to like, and more people, I think, are going to start saying it. That's coming up next.
Real businesses like Malibu Apothecary rely on Spectrum to keep them connected.
We're a fragrance company, but we also have a lot of technology that we use. Spectrum is really the backbone of any of the business we do here. Having a reliable, fast internet service that can fit my budget is really great. I traded a 9-to-5 for a 5-to-9. It's a lot of work, but I love it.
Spectrum Business Internet starts at $40 a month when bundled. Learn more at spectrum.com/business. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.